awareness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. You know, one of the best examples I've ever seen of that, his great-great-great-great-great-grand sponsor was a guy by the name of Bill Hollingsworth, or great-grand sponsor. And Bill Hollingsworth was a fixture in the Atlanta and Virginia areas, and he was died with 40 years of sobriety. And he spoke at the Colorama workshop, which is in Cashers, North Carolina, up in the mountains. And it's something very similar to this. A whole bunch of people would get together for a weekend, and they would have a bunch of different talks. And he was the Sunday morning spiritual renewal speaker. He was the one who was going to wrap it all up and send people on their way. And it was a bad morning. There was a bad set of storms coming through. And boy, you could hear it on the tape. He introduces himself, Bill Hollingsworth, and this morning we're practicing the presence of God. And you hear the loud clap of thunder, and you hear the lights go out because everybody in the room is going, "Huh!" And all of a sudden the lights come back on, and he says, "Well, cool, since God's now with us, we can begin." And that's an overly dramatic example. But today the presence, the consciousness of the presence of God is the most important fact. Man, it goes on to say they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Is that God calling?
God calling.
All right. He then writes, "This world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than in all the millennium which went before. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today, yet in ancient times material progress was painfully slow."
The reason being, I mean, those guys back there could have built rocket ships. They could have split an atom. But superstition and heresy kept them from venturing out. Their minds were no less developed than ours. Yeah. They could have done all that, but superstition said if you venture in there, something really bad's going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. "Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. And in the realm of the material, our minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous, and others came near putting Galileo to death for his astronomical heresies."
We're going to ask you to kind of walk with us for a second, because we believe that Columbus was an alcoholic. Columbus had a strong suspicion. He had a theory that this earth that we live on was round. Most of the other people on the planet believed it to be flat, that if you sailed to the edge, you would drop off into wherever. So he had this strong belief. And one of the reasons we believe that he's alcoholic, he went to the king of Spain, Ferdinand, and he says, "Hey, dude," he says, "how about loaning me some money, give me some ships, some men, and some provisions? I want to sail around this thing and prove that it's round." He says, "Get the hell out of my office." To further conclude or to support our belief is that that him being alcoholic, he got a woman to finance the trip.
Come on.
He went to Isabel and he said, "Hey, baby, he's fuel hooked me up with some boats, some supplies, and a crew. I'll sail around this damn thing and I'll bring you back all sorts of things. I'll bring you back fine furs and scents and gems and precious metals." She said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah, baby." So she did that. And on this first trip, he left here on a suspicion that this theory of his was right. Now, to conclude that we believe he's alcoholic, on this first trip, he hired a special sailor. He put that special sailor up on the bow of the first boat with a lantern. He said, "Look here, dude." He says, "We're running down through there." He says, "If you see the edge of this damn thing," he says, "you go to hooping and hollering and waving that lantern." He says, "We'll turn these boats around." His theory wasn't strong enough to support his bravery because Columbus's butt was on the back boat. He wasn't on that lead boat. To further support our idea of his alcoholism, Columbus believed that you could sail east to get west. When he left, he didn't know where he's going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he'd been. So he gets back, and Isabel says, "Dude, where's my stuff?" He says, "I forgot it."
Hey,
Baby, if you hook me up with some more boats and some more men and some more supplies, I'll bring you back a bunch of this stuff. She said, all right, dude. First, she's the world's first Al-Anon. Yeah. When he left here, here's the meat, y'all. When he left on a theory, on a strong suspicion. Nobody had ever done it. He had a belief. When he left the second time, he left here on unconditional faith. He sat on that front boat up in the big chair because he knew that his theory was right. He left on faith. You see how it develops? And if you're a newcomer in this room today, all we're asking is, do you have a suspicion that what we're doing may have some meat to it? That's all we're doing. Do you have a strong suspicion? That's all this step is.
So we asked ourselves this. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Now, even in the present century, American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Hadn't all efforts at flight failed before? Didn't Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River?
In 1903, a couple of bicycle mechanics, Orville and Wilbur Wright, bicycle mechanics, they had a theory. They had a suspicion that they could string together a few pieces of wood and some rags and put together a machine that would fly. They had tried it one time. It didn't work out too well, and they took it home and fixed it. And so they called this guy at the Charlotte Reporter, Charlotte Observer, and said, man, we're fixing to fly this thing out here on the beach at Kitty Hawk. He said, I'll be out there. So they showed up, and sure enough, in 1903, they got this thing off the ground. They flew it for 90 feet. Superstition said, man can't do that. Fettered ideas. This reporter went back to the publisher of that newspaper and says, man, you ain't going to believe what I saw today. He sees bicycle mechanics flew a contraption across the beach at Kitty Hawk. He says, you ain't printing that mess in my magazine, in my newspaper. He says, people come down here and burn this thing down. True story. Man can't fly. What happened, Christian?
It says, wasn't it true that the best mathematical minds had proved man could never fly? Had not people said God reserved this privilege to the birds? Well, see, only 30 years later, the conquest of the air was almost an old story, and airplane travel was in full swing. Skip down one full paragraph. Even if you read that next paragraph, it talks about something. Bill's basically foretelling the future, you know, about 1969, putting a man on the moon. This pretty much 30-plus years, about 32 years prior to this, he's writing this. It's kind of cool. So the next full paragraph down says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view.
And we're about to read the agnostic promises.
We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I like the way Adam Todd brings these back. When I quit drinking, I was full of fear. When I quit drinking, I couldn't seem to control my emotional natures. When you take alcohol away from me, you take my solution away, I'm left with me, full of fear and depression, misery, and, you know, I'm full of all of these things. And it goes on to say, we had a feeling of uselessness, full of fear, we were unhappy, we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Now, was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And you're left with you when you take alcohol out.
When you walk into these rooms, here's what you see.
We saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe. We had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but this God idea did.
Bingo.
Middle of page 53, it says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't.
There you go. There's no gray area here. Do y'all see any gray area, any fringy edges of this thing? Either he is or he ain't. He's everything or he's nothing. And then it asks you that question, what's your choice going to be? Yeah.
Now, Bill spends the next couple of paragraphs belaboring a point about the intellectual comprehension of the undefinable, of the I'm going to wrap my head around this and figure it out. The bottom of the page on 54 says, hence we saw that reason isn't everything. He's trying to take reason and make it fit into this undefinable thing that we call God. It says, neither is reason, from as most of us use it, entirely dependable, though it emanate from our best minds. What about people who said that man could never fly? Yet we have been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We have seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true.
I love it.
Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God.
So you hear people saying, I found God. Run. God ain't lost. When you fell out of your mother's womb, you had a seeking desire inside you. Everybody in this room, everybody you've ever come in contact with, you've been seeking something. And we sought women, we sought bigger cars, better jobs, more money, bigger motorcycle, all these things. But what it is the fundamental idea of God, of a power greater than yourself. And it says, deep down in here is where God lives. He ain't out there.
That's
he
fundamental.
Smiles, yeah. When we see that out there.
Yeah. That's fundamental.
Yo. Well, yeah, you are. Because it says a belief or willing to believe. When you became alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, whatever that is, your self-imposed crisis was imposed by your drinking, the behaviors and the consequences of that, that you could not postpone or evade. It's there. It's on you. You had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he's nothing. If you want to get out of this, because earlier in the book it said, you got two choices. You can accept a spiritual way of life or die an alcoholic death. And that's where you're at. They're just kind of putting it in different words. What we're doing here, we've already passed step one. We're in step two. And if you can't concede to step two, let me know how that works out. So that's where they're at here. Does that make sense?
Bottom of page 25 says it real simple, too. You know, we can go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, or we can accept spiritual help. Accepting spiritual help is, I don't necessarily have to believe that it's going to work. I can be willing to believe that it might work for you, and I'm watching it happen in your life. But this is something I come back to, because, see, after I get over the drink problem, and I get over the whatever else is killing me problem, now I'm dealing with me and alcoholism without a drink. And my sponsor takes me back here all the time. He says, Christian, either God is everything or he's nothing. Do you think God can keep Saturn on its axis? Do you think he's going to be willing to help you with your financial problem? Do you think God's willing to help you with your relationship problem? God is everything or he's nothing. It's going to ultimately be the solution to all of my problems. God is everything or he's nothing.
I micromanage the universe.
Yeah, he does.
I'm really good at it. I walked into a guy's office. He's been the CEO of a large men's treatment facility in Atlanta for 30-something years. And he's wise beyond his years. And he knows me as good as anybody knows me. And she had left, and it was ugly. And I was trying to figure out a way to manipulate our lives back together. And Doug sat back in his chair. He had them reading glasses down on his nose. And he says, Larry, when are you going to resign? I said, and I knew what he was talking about, but I played stupid. I said, what are you talking about, Doug? He said, when are you going to resign from being the the head of the universe. I said, Doug, what are you talking about? And he always does this. If he rears back with them glasses, just get ready. He said, and he says, God, he said, Larry, either God is or he's not. He's everything or he's nothing. Mm. So what this man had said to me was, my reliance upon myself had failed me utterly. It was over. And nothing I could do to manipulate it or hotwire this deal was going to change it. I had to rely on God. And Chaz and I had this conversation last night. He's going through a difficult time right now. I've got to rely on God and what God has made possible in my life. I'm a womanizer. I'm a member of that 3F club. You find them and forget them. But what I've done for the last 2.5 years with the God of my understanding's help and guidance is I haven't been in a relationship and I'm okay with it. You don't know me. This one knows me. And what I've just shared with you is phenomena. And I don't mean that lightly. But I heard Doug, either God is or he's not. He's everything or he's nothing. And Christian just said it. He can keep Saturn on its axis, but what about her? Can he bring her back? No.
All right. It says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another, it's there.
Usually he's hidden by her.
For faith and a power are greater than ourselves, and a miraculous demonstration of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. So we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were.
All right. He keeps giving us this open option. Remember when Christian did this? The highway is broad and roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive. It keeps doing like this. He says, by some kind of God. Faith in some kind of God. You ain't got to believe in mine. You ain't got to believe in my concept. You can borrow them. Come on, let's go. But that's up to you. You can't argue with your own conception, ever how small it may be. Hmm.
Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us.
Inside you.
In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us.
Wow. We've covered God up with all the insanity.
Now, Bill has done something here, and you'll hear people say to a new guy when they walk through the door, read how it works. God, please don't. They're not going to have any clue why they're sitting here. Being convinced of what? Or am I convinced of an alcohol? Take them to the blank page. Take them to the doctor's opinion. There's a solution. More about alcoholism. We agnostics. They're designed to bring us to this point. The book says we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps you sweep away prejudice. If our testimony enables you to think honestly, if our testimony encourages you to search diligently within yourself,
then,
if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway.
It says, if you wish. What this book is doing right here is setting you up for a decision that's coming on at 6:30 tonight or whenever our next session is.
It says, with this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you.
There's that attitude thing. And there's a promise. Cannot fail.
We're going to flip over to page 57. Wrap up this little part here. They ask the question. That page 56 talks about a guy named Fitz Mayo. It's a great little story, our southern friend. But it talks about his little experience with God. And the 57, the first full paragraph says, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. See if you can hook up with this. Circumstances made us willing to believe. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we couldn't postpone or evade. We had to clearly face the proposition that God is everything or he's nothing. When you all hemmed up and you got the butt of the nickel-plated 35 or 32 against the back of your head and you're feeling that click as the hammer's being pulled back, you suddenly become very open-minded to things. And when you're staring at yourself in the mirror and you realize that you are the cause of your own pain and misery, you become very open-minded to things. So what this is the whole point of this, is to bring us to a position to where we realize apart from a power greater than ourselves, we're doomed. So that's where we're at. Circumstances made us willing to believe. We humbly offered ourselves to our Maker, and then we know. Even so, as God restored us all to our right minds. To Fitz Mayo, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. But He has come to all who have honestly sought Him. When we drew near to Him, He disclosed Himself to us.
Guys, we're going to end this session, but I want to leave you with something. We have just completed step two. If you're a sponsor in this program and in this fellowship, please, I beg you, do not take that new guy and hand him this book and say, go home and read how it works and give me a call tomorrow. Christian just alluded to it. He has no idea what the hell he's reading. Take him through, starting at the blank page, and help him to understand what he's suffering from, alcoholism, and how hopeless that dilemma is. Step one, conclusion of the mind, observation, conclusion of the mind. Step two is a strong suspicion, conclusion of the mind. And that's where we're at. They're not working steps. So, y'all have any questions on the first two steps, what we've done so far? We'll see you here this afternoon. We're going to be back here at 5:30. No. Yeah, how much is in it?
Don't take the money, Larry.
My name's Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Larry.
And I'm free this evening, and I hope you are. I don't know what you guys did with the free time, but I haven't moved. I love you guys. I mean, it's just been one steady dialogue. Don't you have a fire to start or something? Jesus Christ. Remember in Tombstone, Billy Bob Thornton? He's sitting there playing cards with those guys. He said, Jesus Christ. I feel like I'm playing cards with my brother's kids or something. You nerve-wracking sons of bitches. I got to tell you, honest to God, and I mean this with everything in me. I don't know what your experience is this weekend. For this alcoholic, God is in, he's in session. He showed up. And my heart has been listening and speaking to the hearts of you men that have given of yourselves sitting around this table and out in the pool room and that. Just amazing. There's so many similarities between this workshop and the one that we do back in Atlanta. Just so many similarities. I mean, this is Native American spiritual ground. And I thought it was the river, and it is, but you couple that with what's here, the heritage, and it's just kind of overwhelming. And thank you guys for sharing you with me this afternoon. It's been amazing. We are going to forge forward tonight and try and get as far into this deal as we can. We're horrified of snow, and we're riding with Evil Knievel over here. And, you know, we're going to forge forward tonight, and we're going to try and get as far into this text as we can. And so just bear with us. I know there's going to be cupcakes and ice cream calling you. If you need to, if you can't, if the obsession overtakes you, think of us. All right. Guys, where we're at right now, we have gone through all this time. We've covered step one. We've talked about that we're powerless over alcohol. It's the obsession of the mind. And that our lives have become unmanageable. And then in this last session, we stirred some people's souls a little bit. We troubled them about the question of a higher power and of their own alcoholism. It brought forth a lot of discussion. In between these sessions, it brought forth questions. And where we're at now is we're moving into the fifth chapter, how it works. And we're approaching the third step decision. And tonight, Christian is going to read for you the original manuscript as it was before They boiled it down into the form that we know so intimately in our books. You get it. So that's where we're at. Christian's going to read this original manuscript for us. And I ask you to follow along and notice the subtle differences, if you want to call them subtle. My opinion is that I wish to hell they'd left it alone. I love the original manuscript.
My name is Christian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7th, 2001. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. I was like, anybody ever heard Bill Wilson read it? Rarely have we seen a person, you know, it's this real nasally Northeast. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest.
Did you notice they use the word honest and honesty three times here?
Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions.
All right, it says if you've decided you want what we have, that's a step three decision, guys.
At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. One, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Can I interrupt you just a second? Before we get into these steps, up to this point, there had been six things, the six tenets. Bill Wilson grabbed a pencil and a piece of paper. He got on his knees and asked God for guidance and direction. And he laid down in his bed. And what came from that prayer and direction were these 12 things that you're reading. Bill got up, he looked at them in review. And he thought, wow, these were inspired because there's 12 steps. They're 12 disciples. So he's sitting around all puffed up about its accomplishment, and there's a couple of guys from AA, Fellowship. Hey, Bill, got any coffee? Yeah, come on in, boys. We got 12 things. And they lost their minds. They said, you idiot. We had six things. What are you doing? We're good with the six things. Now we got 12. It would be like you going back to your home group tomorrow and finding out they got 24 things. So, this is how the 12 things came about.
Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back.
Come on.
Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, my first sponsor used to do that. What's the point? The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. Principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will, period. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point, or else throw it away.
I love that. In your book, the next words that you see, it says, being convinced. Being convinced of what, guys? Step one and two. It's asking you that question. It says, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. A lot of people in this fellowship hear this. They hear step three, that we turned our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. That's not what the step says. The step says we made a decision. Right now, I have made a decision that I'm going on a cruise in May. I've got it booked. I've got my money put down. But somewhere around May 3rd or so, I need to start throwing some rags in a suitcase. Put a little gasoline in that car of mine and head towards Savannah. Because see, all I've done right now is made a decision. You with us? You guys made a decision some months ago that you were going to come to this retreat this weekend. You paid your money. But until you put the rags in the bag and got in the car and came here, all you had was a decision. So all this step says is you're making a decision to do the rest of the work. Steps 4 through 12. It's all the step says. Nothing more and nothing less. It says, which is that we decided to turn our will and life. Your will, if you got a pen, your will is your thoughts and wants. Your life is your actions. You're making a decision to turn your thoughts and your wants and your actions over to the care of God as you understand God. All action is born in thought. During the course of this weekend, you've seen me drink a couple of 3 gallons of this water. And you're going to see me probably drink a couple more gallons before I leave. And here's why. I have a case of dry mouth. But I don't sit here and just knee-jerk reach out and grab that glass. The dry mouth sets in. I think about it. I grab the water and I drink it. So I think about it before I do it. Everything you do, every action you do is born in thought. You understand what I'm saying? Please don't let me lose you here. When we're talking about our will, our thoughts and our wants, there are two wills. There's Larry's will, or your will, man's will, self-will, if you will. And there's God's will. when he made human beings, he made us different than all the other animal species on the planet. And what he gave us is a power of choice. He gave us free will where we could make decisions on what it is that we wanted to do. That's where we get in trouble. The book says that we're extreme examples of self-will run riot. A lot of the things that we get in trouble with this self-will, has to do with money and sex. Animals are God-directed, not us. There's a story that I'm going to tell, and it's about salmon. Salmon aren't indigenous to my area, but here's what happened. One night I was tossing and turning, and I got up and I turned on some TV show, TBS, History Channel, whatever it was, and it showed this little still pool, glassy, smooth water, and then the camera went just below the water, and there were these little salmon in there. They're swimming around. This blew my mind now. So when I'm hooking up with Frank yesterday and he's showing me all this stuff about your area, I'm just like, whoa. Because I tell this story at every book study. And now I'm in the heart of where this story probably took place. It's cool stuff. So these little salmon, this little salmon clock goes off and they hit that rapid and they go down in the spring melt. And they follow those rapids, much like this Mackenzie out here probably, and they end up at the ocean. And when they get to that ocean, they scatter. And they swim out thousands of miles. Well, they're out there doing whatever little salmon do, the ones that make it. And then all of a sudden, that God clock goes off. Ding, 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 ding. And they turn their little salmon butts around. They ain't got no GPS. They got that deal built in. And they turn around thousands of miles and they go back to the mouth of that creek, that river where they were born. And they swim up these rapids. And they're jumping over rocks and debris. And the bears are hanging out on them rocks because they just woke up and they're hungry. And every now and then they reach out there and they snag one. Some of these salmon, these are huge fish, and they jump and they hit a rock and they die. But they're on a mission from God, make no mistake. Because they're headed back to where they were born. And their mission is to go back up in there and recreate. And that's what they do. And after they spawn, these two adults die. And the cycle starts all over again. And I'm sitting there going, wow. So Frank tells me yesterday that these two guys, the two older guys, die because they can't reacclimate to the fresh water after being in the ocean. I didn't know that. But my point is, these two little old dogs I got back at home, they're not sitting there wondering what it would be like to nail that poodle down on the corner. That's not the way they think. They recreate as directed by God. That's the way animals do it. Us, we're wondering how it would be hanging or tied down or blindfolded or tickled or spanked. You know what I'm talking about? We go to extremes. And the other thing we do is, you know, there's a lot of people sitting behind the wall today because they want our money. And they take it by all sorts of means, by gunpoint, and they do it in white-collar crime. Money and sex are our two big deals. But the animals are God-directed. So this alcoholic, my desire and my prayer is that God would help me to align my will with His. Because when I go off on my deal, I'm in trouble. Johnny and I have had a lot of conversation today about the sexual thing and how God has made it possible for us over the last couple of years to get ourselves more in line with that. With that piece of human fabric that's so corroded, and that's that sexual instinct. So, being convinced, we're at step three, that we decided to turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understand Him.
next paragraph starts by saying the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. My first sponsor entertained an idea. He says, Christian, I want you to write down all those things that you have initiated in your life that are still running well today. I'm thinking, good, this can be easy. I started to write. Damn, I don't have anything. Nothing that I've started or initiated in my own life is still running well. They might have started out great, but they fizzled out quickly. Or they started out kind of, the guy may have lasted for a while, but then I either abandoned it or it fell apart. You know, living a life on self-will can hardly be a success. And that was an exercise he put me through. It says that on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good.
I need to go back for just a second. I'm sorry. I wrote this on the wrong page. But back in the original manuscript that he read, Bill said, you, he used the word must, and he used the direction, word direction. And the guys that were reading this original manuscript said, hey, dude, you can't tell an alcoholic that you must or directions. So this guy, Dr. Howard, non-alcoholic guy from Montclair, New Jersey, he suggested to Bill that he change the word you to we or us. The word must to ought and direction to suggestion. And Bill's response to this was fine. I'll change the word. He said, but y'all need to leave me the hell alone or else write this book yourself. He said, oh, easy, Bill. Just an idea. So he took those three words out for a couple of pages. He puts them right back in again. Mm-hmm. Bill's cunning, baffling, and powerful.
On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Now, Bill's going to take a privilege as executive author, and he's going to go into an expression. And he's going to illustrate in a number of different ways how we leave the generally acceptable playing field. And he's going to compare it to an actor in a play. And it's a one-act play. It's our life. And he talks about it like this. Most people try to live on self-propulsion. Each person's like the actor trying to run the whole show. We're forever trying to arrange lights, ballet, scenery, all the rest of the players in our own way. If my arrangements would only stay put, I'm going to put me in first person in this because, see, this is exactly how I lived my life. If only people would do as I wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including me, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make my arrangements, I may sometimes be quite virtuous. I may even be kind, considerate, patient, generous, modest, and even self-sacrificing. On the other hand, I may even be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest, but as with everyone, I am likely to have some varied traits. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. You know, I'm going to skip down a little bit. The middle of the paragraph says, what is my basic trouble? Am I not really a self-seeker, even when I'm trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well? I like the illustration Scott Lee uses. How many people wanted to believe that 100% that if you just got that bike that you wanted when you were 7 or 8 years old, that you would be happy? That was my experience. I wanted this particular bike, dirt bike. My buddy down the street had one, and I wanted one, and I got it. And then another guy down the street had a bigger, shinier, faster bike, and I wanted his bike. But damn it, I just got this new one. I can't do anything with it. If I just get her, it'll be great. If I just land this job, it'll be great. If I just get that house, it'll be great. If I could just get rid of her, it'll be great. I'm under the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction, that I could wrestle some sort of satisfaction out of this world by managing well. That first half of step one talks about being powerless over alcohol. The second half of step one talks about my life being unmanageable. The main reason is because I'm trying to manage it. You know? And it goes on to say, is it not evident to everyone that these are the things that I want? And do not my actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all that they can get out of the show? Am I not even in my best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Bill goes on to compare a number of different ways that we may experience our actor, politician, reformer, minister, outlaw safecracker, and alcoholic. Gives us different ways that we may show up as the actor in this play. But it goes on to the first paragraph of 62 saying that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. That pissed me off when I first saw that because I really thought alcohol was the root of my troubles. I really thought she was the root of my troubles. I really thought they were the root of my troubles. But it's selfish and self-centeredness is the root of my troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate.
This is all, this whole paragraph is highlightable information, y'all. This is powerful stuff.
Sometimes they hurt me, seemingly without provocation, but I invariably find, at some time in the past, I have made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. And this is bad news right here. It says, so my troubles, I think, are basically of my own making. Damn. They arise out of me, and I am, as an alcoholic, I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually didn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness.
See, he's brought those words right back in there again.
We must, or it kills us. It sounds like a death threat. It goes on to say that God makes that possible.
What we're talking about here is that window of grace that we had. I'll take you up on that tomorrow. We look grace in the face and we think, I'll take this pass tomorrow, but today I'm going to go ahead and run my life. Kristen and I talked about this last night in the room. In the last 24 months, 19 people that have visited our group, some home group members, some not, 19 people have died in our group that have come through our doors. People are dying. So when we talk about this grace, grace runs out. When that window pops up, we need to jump through it. Do you hear what I'm saying to you?
Go. Goes on to say, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. So this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, here's our third step decision. We decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be our director. Now, he spent a number of paragraphs talking about the actor, trying to forever arrange the scenery, the lights, the ballet, all the rest of the players. If you would just do, you walk in, okay, here's how it's going to go down. I'm going to walk through the door, and as I start to tell the boss exactly what I think of him, you're going to come in, you're going to put your arms around me and keep me from hitting them, you know, and you're going to do this, and then they don't show up when they're supposed to, or he doesn't react the way they're supposed to, or it starts raining, or if it, what happens? The show doesn't suit me very well, and it's your fault. You know, Bill has spent a number of pages talking about a relationship between a director and an actor. Now he's going to talk about God is going to be the director. God is the principal. We're his agents. You should take an opportunity to look up that word agents. Agents in this little dictionary. One of my favorite promises is in page, I think it's 152 or 151. It talks about, why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. Think about that. And listen to this definition. Agents, those given power to act for or represent another. I'm an agent for God, and he empowers me to represent him on the next case walking through the door. Because there's going to be somebody just like me who's hurting and dying from this disease, and I get to act as an agent for God. God's the director, I'm the actor. He's the principal, I'm his agent. It goes on to say, he is the father and I'm his child. These are relationships that I get to embark upon once I make that third step decision. I get to enter into a relationship that I've never had. And he gives us three on this page, and it goes on to say, most good ideas are simple And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which I will pass to freedom.
And there it is. This is that arch chart that's in your... Am I on? Yeah. This is the arch chart that's in your packet. If you notice up at the top, it says this is the keystone, because without this, you guys are in construction, without that, this thing collapses on itself. This is the part that keeps it all together. Once again, decision to do this work. It's all you're doing. Okay? The new and triumphant arch through which we pass, free men.
Top of 63 says, when we sincerely took such a position. And what position am I taking? I'm taking the position that he's going to be the director, I'm the actor. He's the father, I'm the child. He is the principal, I'm his agent. When I sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. Here's another relationship. We have a new employer. I can hook up with employer, employee, father and child, director and actor, principal and agent. I can hook up with all of them. But these are all, and they're different types of relationships. If you look up the words and understand the dictionary definitions of them, these are types of relationships I get to have. See, I got a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. There was one relationship, and I was told I would never be good enough to be in it. I didn't come from the right stock. I didn't have the right teachings. I didn't have the right doctrines. I wasn't part of the right club, and I wasn't going to be able to be a part of that. And I knew it. That's an old idea. This book's telling me I can enter into one of four different types of relationships. It says, we have a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed
if
we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such footing, we become less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we feel new power flow in, as we enjoy peace of mind, as we discover we could face life successfully. That was something I knew I would never be able to do. I was never going to be able to face life successfully. And this book is making an outlandish claim that you can. We became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today and tomorrow and the hereafter. We were reborn.
Sounds like a bunch of promises, doesn't it, guys? All right.
Success, things working out. For me, that's success. Things working out. Maybe not necessarily the way I want them to, because I'm working in a job I never would have picked, and engaged to a woman I never would have picked, and living a life I never would have picked. But it seems to be working out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys, we're coming up to a part of this book. We've been doing this for a minute. And what we do here is going to be an option for you. We're going to invite you to do this third step prayer with us. The difference in this book study and others that you may have attended or heard, we do this step individually, one at a time. You can do it standing up, sitting down, laying down, on your knees. It don't differ. I pray on my knees. My sponsor told me that it's impossible for me not to be humble if I'm on my knees. And I'm going to read this third step prayer. Before I read it, the following paragraph, it says, the wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation. I don't speak in King James.
Anymore.
If I ever walk up to you and say, hey dude, how art thou? Slap me, because I've taken leave of my senses.
He's drinking.
Yeah, I'm drinking. Buy me a beer.
And he's drinking some old scotch whiskey.
All right. Here's what this prayer says. Before I start reading it, please take notice there's no amen at the end of this, because amen signifies an ending. This is the beginning. We were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to You. That's the first part. To build with me and to do with me as You see fit. This is God's work. And then I asked God to relieve me of the bondage of self. The book just told me that's the root of my problems. That I may better do Your will. It says, take away my difficulties. Difficulties with what? I'm about to embark on a personal inventory. I'm about to sit down with another man and tell him the difficulties of my life, the shortcomings of my life. Then I'm going to make a list of all these people that I've harmed. And then I'm going to go out amongst these people and make direct amends to each and every one of them. But we're asking God to take away those difficulties. Why? So that victory over those difficulties will bear witness to these guys that are coming up behind me, that I'm going to walk through this work. They're going to see my results and they're going to say, wow, you didn't die from that. Maybe I got a shot. So that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help with what? Your power, because I didn't do this, Your love, and Your way of life. And then it says, may I do Your will always. Okay, once again, no scorekeeping. I'm going to start this deal out, and I'm going to invite John to pray, and then Christian, and we can go around like this. Last week we did this in Hilton Head, and it was popping up all over the place. But to keep it in order, let's just go down the road. If you choose not to do it, cool. No big deal. No scorekeeping.
Real quick. After we pray, he's actually going to turn the recording off. So there's no... Because it won't pick it up, but therefore there's no worries of...
You guys ready? God, offer myself to You to build with me and to do with me as You see fit. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Your will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Your love, Your power, and Your way of life. May I do Your will always.
God, I offer myself to You to build with me and to do with me as You will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, Father, that I may better do Your will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of Your power and Your love, and Your way of life. May I do Your will always.
Bill's a tricky guy. He says, we found it... he says, we thought well before taking this step. Why did he put that afterwards? Making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. It says, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. I just took this step with a room full of really good friends. But it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning.
Damn! Only a beginning?
Though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Mm. What they mean by that is, through this decision, you've invited God to help you through with the rest of this process. And you know you don't have to be alone again. Once again, I'm going to just remind you of what we just did here in this room. We made a decision to do the rest of the work. you are not powerful enough to turn your will and your life over to the care of God yet. There's a lot of garbage between you and God. You have to clear away this debris by doing the work. Steps 4 through 9. And then we draw near to our Creator. You guys take 5 minutes. We'll come back and embark on the next step. Guys, we've been hammering it all weekend long about getting in here and getting busy. Let's do this thing. Let's get sober. Let's move on with this thing. People, the fellowship is talking about different timelines. Don't rush into taking the steps. Well, the book is really, really clear. You just got off your knees. I have no idea what you experienced, but I invited Johnny up here because from this vantage point, it's a powerful deal. These guys huddling up and doing these prayers in little groups. I'd venture to guess these are probably sponsors with their guys. You know what I'm saying? Last weekend in Hilton Head Island, we were sitting at the table, and this guy over here, he teaches Hebrew doctrine, and we didn't even get going good. And he's a great big guy. This guy was probably 6'4". He broke down and he started crying. It set the tone for the whole thing. And he did the prayer. And then all of a sudden, these little groups of people huddling up, holding hands and doing the prayer. And all of a sudden, the sniffling started. The most powerful experience that we've had was in Savannah. What were we over there, 3 weeks ago, a month ago? There's a guy that came in. He looked just like Colonel Harlan Sanders. This guy looked like him. I'm telling you, this was him. And his name was Bob, and Bob and I connected when he walked in because he was a character. And at every break, Bob and I would get together and banter back and forth. Went around the room. There was 58 people in the room that Saturday afternoon. And when we get done, I just like to be quiet because the unity and the energy in the room, I don't know what you felt, but I feel it. Yeah. What you said. But we're sitting here being quiet. Christian and I are kind of looking at each other and kind of letting that room settle down. About 3 seconds into it, Bob goes, "I need to say something." And I went, we got this silence going. He just blurts it out. And I said, "What's up, Bob?" And he can't talk. He's 77 years old. Can't talk. He's crying so hard. And finally he goes, took him about 3 minutes to say this. He says, "I walked into these rooms an atheist," and he started crying again. And he couldn't get it out until he just blurted it. He helped choke back the tears. He says, "But so help me, my God Almighty, from this day forward, I'll do this exercise." And everybody went, "Whoa." Bob got baptized last Sunday. Not saying that's what's in your future. I'm just telling you, this guy had a sudden and profound impact on his life. And it's a powerful thing. The timeline now, you've just gotten off your knees, you've made a decision to invite the God of your understanding in to help you with this work. So when do you start the fourth step?
Next.
You ever watch the space shuttle? When it lifts off, it's spitting gas and flames and it's belching and puking and it's getting it, man. That dude's getting it. They call that launching. It says, "Next, we launched. Let's go." On a vigorous is strenuous effort, energetic, action.
The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. I have yet to run into somebody who was doing personal house cleaning when they walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just doesn't happen. Though our decision, what was our decision? To quit playing God. Though our decision was vital and crucial, it could have little permanent effect unless at once I like the way Scott Lee puts it. Somewhere between next and at once. We're going to do some work. We can haggle a little bit over the exact time frame, but between next and at once.
And vital is life-sustaining. It's a life-sustaining process. Crucial. We're big on words up here. Essential. The very important. It's very, very important in the determination of an issue. The issue at hand is house cleaning.
The issue at hand is alcoholism and living through it. Unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us.
Blocking us from what?
Sunlight of the Spirit.
So you made a decision. Please don't confuse it. You hadn't turned your will and your life over to anything. You made a decision to invite God in to help you with the rest of the work. That's all you've done.
Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions.
You ever ask somebody, what step are you on? Well, I'm on step three. How do you do that? Well, how about this one? What step are you on? Well, I'm on step one. Really? Step one's done out there, y'all.
Smell the breath.
Yeah, I mean, you're on step one. You're out there. Are you drinking? Because step one's done out in the street. Step one ran us in here. I'm on step two. Really? You see where I'm going with this? Observation, conclusion. Suspicion, conclusion.
Book says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. My favorite subject, me. This was step four. Now he's going to go on to compare a business with us. And a business which takes an irregular inventory usually goes broke. Taking commercial inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose the damaged or unsellable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We take stock honestly. Searching and fearless moral. I had the problem with the word moral until somebody took me to a dictionary and suggested that it was nothing more than a truthful. So taking stock honestly. First, we search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, why are we convinced? Remember in step three we came to this place where we were convinced that any life led on self-will can hardly be a success? So I'm convinced that that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us. I consider self and its common manifestations. Resentment's the number one offender. Resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. That's bad news for us. From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease. For I've been not only mentally and physically ill, I've been spiritually sick.
Resentment. Break it down. R-E is again to repeat. Zent comes from the word sentire, Latin word. Means to feel, to re-feel. We alcoholics have got a built-in replay machine. That instant replay deal. Many of you guys are old enough, you remember when Theismann was quarterback for the Redskins. And that linebacker came back in that backfield and snapped his lower leg. And the guy in the booth said, "My God, Bob, did you see that? Let's see it again, Jim." And they re-ran it, and the guy gets up, his leg goes back together, and here comes that linebacker. Bam, breaks his leg again. Now, how many times do we see that? How about those planes flying into the towers? Thank God they quit showing that. They replay it. So what happens with us, we get this instant replay machine, and something that happened 20, 30 years ago, we replay it, and the more we replay it, the bigger, the more fantastic it gets. A couple of young men, when I was young men, my butt, they were little boys. When I was in grade school, I'm in the bathroom. And these guys came in, these two guys, and they flanked me on either side of the urinal. They said something to me about my anatomy. I'm 7 years old. Broke my heart, hurt my feelings. For years, I wouldn't change clothes in front of you. That's just the way I was. We were at the pool yesterday, and there was a little boy there, and his buddy got dressed in front of us, and the other one went in the stall. I could relate to that kid. You with me? So what happened, I'm 7 years old. I come into your rooms at age 40, Guess who goes on my resentment sheet? These two punks from grade school. Once I get it out of here and onto paper, I'm going, I can't believe that these guys have rented this space for 37 years. It's stupid. But boy, in my head, it was this big deal, those son of a bitches. But it's laughable. Joe McQuaney said it, man. You want to take the power out of a resentment, get it out of your head and on paper. Look at it. It's ridiculous. But it's what? Blocked us off from God. Because we've blown it out of proportion. To refill resentment.
The book suggests that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically.
Obsession and allergy's gone.
Now, the allergy never goes away. We just don't trigger it. We stay spiritually fit. We don't get emotionally restless, irritable, and discontented. Therefore, I don't need a drink. I'm never cured of alcoholism. But I'm no longer thirsty. And if I'm not thirsty, I won't drink as long as I stay spiritually fit. Book says in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, again, so many people have said this 1,000 times. They're going to say it better than we have. And the most important thing I can say about a resentments list or a fears list or a harms list, any kind of fourth step list, I don't care if it's 2 columns, 3 columns, 4 columns, 5 columns, California version, check boxes, long-winded write-outs. The only wrong way I've seen to do a fourth step is to not do a fourth step. We have adopted Joe and Charlie's method of doing the fourth step. It's right out of the book, keeps it real simple. We like to complicate the hell out of some things. And the most important thing we can say is that it works. It's not the end all in fourth steps. So we've merely adopted what Joe and Charlie have done.
And something that our buddy Chris Raymer says, is this on? Can you hear me? Huh? You can hear me now. Can you hear me now?
Well, you got it upside down, Harold.
You need to start pressing.
How's that?
How's that?
Are we together? Chris Raymer says pull out a business card, write it on the back. Get it out of your head and on the paper. My one of my original sponsors, Chris DeBolt, said, we got to do the steam pipe thing. You know, steam builds up pressure in a pipe, and if you don't get some release off of it, it's going to blow. Get this stuff out, the worst things. Get it on paper. Let's go. Let's get some of this pressure off. Because you're about to die here. Okay? The book says we put them on paper. This sheet is in your packet. This sheet's in your packet. We good?
Sure.
The hell's so funny. Y'all tell us. Let me in.
Well, the guys back there are like cut off from
the side. How y'all doing? Next time, pay more money and get a better seat. All right. I couldn't help it. You got a sheet for people like me. What you do here. Bill has used the term clear-cut directions a great deal, and I'm going to give you some of these. When you're setting these on paper, list the resentment. And what you want to do is you want to forget these columns exist. Please follow along. This is important. You want to list the people, places, and institutions that you're pissed off at, top to bottom. Make copies of this sheet because you're going to need more, especially you new guys. If you only got 7 resentments, you might be still thirsty.
If you only got 7 resentments, call the DMV. They'll help you with the rest.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What you want to do is you want to list these things top to bottom, top to bottom, top to bottom, top to bottom. And once you get all those people, places, and things that you're resentful at, then you come over to 2. Here's the reason you don't do this. The human nature will tell you that it's natural to